Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Drive around the Pennsylvania countryside and you'll see some of the most beautiful and unique barns anywhere.
So these historic Pennsylvania barns in the Susquehanna Valley, along with the open farmland and the historic fence rows and the pasture lands and the rural roads and the small bridges, are all part of that landscape fabric that tell the story of a place and of a people and of a time. Why did that farmer build that barn? What were they growing that they needed a barn that shape or that style or in that location? It's the story of the Susquehanna Valley.
That's from the documentary film Barns of the Susquehanna Valley that will air tonight on WITF-TV at 8. On today's Smart Talk, we have a conversation about historic and architecturally unique barns and other aspects of barns as well. Joining us is Jonathan Slade, producer of the documentary Barns of the Susquehanna Valley. Professor Slade is also chair of the Department of Communication and Cinema at McDaniel College in Westminster, Maryland. Professor Slade, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also joining us today from historic Gettysburg, Adams County, Barn Preservation Program Designer Kurt Musselman and Preservation Specialist David McClay. Gentlemen, welcome to the show as well.
Good morning, Scott.
Good morning. Thank you so much.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Jonathan Slade, let me start with you. Why a documentary about barns of the Susquehanna Valley?
Well, I grew up in a small family farm in Carroll County, Maryland, with my three brothers, and we grew up like working and playing in these historic barns that were in the valleys and the valley around where I grew up. And they've always been something of interest to me. You know, we used to throw straw and hay in the summer, and at the time there was just a place to play and to work. But as I got older and sort of got into documentary filmmaking, I always tell my students, tell stories you're uniquely suited to tell. And I started thinking, I don't think I've ever really seen a comprehensive documentary on historic barns. And they really are, they stand at the cornerstone of the history of America. I mean, farmers came and they built these barns and they built these houses and they spread across the frontier. And so they fascinate me. And I wanted to take a look at them standing on the shoulders of some really great work that was done by barn historians. And just kind of document the barns, the people who care about them, their architectural significance, their agricultural significance, and their historical significance. And so I had an opportunity in 2010 to begin working on a project at Maryland Public Television. I completed one on historic barns of Maryland. And it was more than anything I've ever done in my life. I just had a reaction. People just loved barns, and they were like, we've never seen anything about it. So then I started on a project, Barns of the Susquehanna Valley.
You anticipated my next question is, why barns here in central Pennsylvania? And I'm going to ask a follow-up question to that. Are barns in central Pennsylvania, the Susquehanna Valley, any different than Carroll County or places in Maryland?
That is a great question, because when I spent a year and a half working on historic barns in Maryland, Maryland Public TV came back to me and said, we'd like another show right away. Well, what do you want? Well, more of the same. And I didn't want to do it. I wanted to try to find a different story to tell. And so I just looked across the Mason-Dixon line to south central Pennsylvania. And it's amazing how different some of the barns are. Like, I'll give you three examples real quick, if I can remember them. One is that there's way more stone barns in Pennsylvania than there are in Maryland. You know, everywhere you turn, you see these wonderful stone bank barns up here, which there are stone barns in Maryland, but not as many. The second is that there's the Amish influence up here that we don't really have as much down in Maryland. And the third is, and this is from David Marr from the Pennsylvania Museum and Historical and Museum Commission, is that literally railroads in south central Pennsylvania were built specifically to carry agricultural goods. So they were built, the railroads were built in reflection of where the barns were built in the area, which is different than in Maryland. So
never heard that.
Just literally crossing the border, there's like a whole different world of barns that we could explore.
I'm curious about the stone barns. Any reason that there are more stone barns in central Pennsylvania than in Maryland?
Well, again, there's barn historians that could probably speak to this better than myself.
I'm going to talk to a couple here.
But what my understanding from the people I've spoke to is literally you build barns out of the materials that are readily available. And, you know, down in Maryland where I live, you know, there's a lot of wood. There's certainly a lot of timber up here as well. But there's a lot of times they would have stone quarries on these properties, and they could literally quarry the stone within a quarter mile or half a mile from where the barn was built. And then you build it out of like the most resilient material you can get that's nearby. And so that's stone in this area. area.
So, gentlemen from Gettysburg, historic Gettysburg, Adams County, why the fascination with barns amongst your organization?
Okay, well, our organization, Historic Gettysburg, Adams County, as the name suggests, is an umbrella preservation organization for all of the county. And when we were founded back in 1975, our Declaration of Preservation, as it was actually written by Bruce Catton, a famous historian. So what we see in barns is that they're an important part of the cultural landscape. So we have Land Conservancy of Adams County that wants to keep the open land, but we feel it's important to get the character of the land to have these barns as part of it. One of our early projects that HGAC did actually was to mark the hospitals in and around the battlefield at Gettysburg. And some years after we did that and we maintained those signs, we noticed that we have about 50 hospitals marked. About half of them were in barns. Mm-hmm. And so we realized that these barns have more of a story to tell than just the traditional agricultural stories as far as Gettysburg and Adams County goes. Mm-hmm. So that's where then we started the idea of, well, why don't we start a project to help the owners of the barns preserve them.
And Gettysburg and Adams County is in a unique position because, one of the most historic events in the history of this country occurred in Gettysburg and Adams County. And as you said, half the barns, actually I'm surprised not a little bit more than that, were used as hospitals. I mean, was there a conscious effort to preserve those barns because they were so much part of history? Or was it after the battle was, okay, we're farmers, we're going after the wounded soldiers are gone, we're going back to farming?
No, you're right. It was more, we're going back to farming. And as far as a conscious effort to preserve the historic barns related to the Battle of Gettysburg, there are actually 39 historic barns from the Civil War era or shortly thereafter within the legislative boundary of the Gettysburg battlefield. So you could say, okay, it's been identified. These 39 barns should be preserved as part of the landscape. But the Park Service actually only owns 25 of them. So we have 14 privately owned barns that have identified historic significance. And no one really had an agenda, what are we going to do to preserve those? So this fits within the scope of our project because we say, well, the campaign in Battle of Gettysburg, over 150,000 troops, you can't take 6,000 acres and say this is where the only significant things happen. So that's where we opened it up for the entire landscape of Adams County because they might not have been fighting there, it might not have been the hospital ground, but they probably, as I know from living on a farm that was basically raided by the rebels on their retreat from the battle, the barn is still standing there, and that's where they took the horses, the cattle, the sheep, everything from.
You still have bitterness about that?
You mean about the rebels?
Yeah, I was going to say. Mitzi Trosel, who is a longtime worker here at WITF, Trosel, recognize
right.
The name, the family from Gettysburg and right near the peach orchard,
the Trosel
farm
barn.
Right down there, and it knows the story of family eating dinner and farm being taken over. So I was just curious of whether you knew that story of your family as well.
Well, and that's it. There are so many stories when you start getting into the whole event there at Gettysburg. And so this is just another way for people to tie in and understand. And, of course, with the hospital part of the suffering and destruction that went on.
Yeah. So, David McClay, you are a preservation specialist. Talk about what you're looking for when you're looking to preserve barns.
Well, yeah, I've been volunteering for HGAC for about 15 years, and then in the past couple of years, contract as the barn preservation specialist. For me personally, growing up and getting into these old barns really informed and inspired my career path, essentially, as a timber framer and historic restoration carpenter. I've spoken before in presentations about walking into these barns, and it feels almost as if you're walking into a cathedral, just the expanse of timber and engineering, the perfect combination of form and function. And like Kurt and Jonathan said, every barn tells a story. Every decision to build a barn was an expression of hope for the people that were there. They're like, by golly, we're going to build a barn. And over time, of course, as the agricultural economy has shifted away from these smaller, more diversified local farm economies, many have stayed in agricultural production and been retrofitted for dairy or larger cattle operations, but some, of course, have fallen into disrepair through neglect and just the practicality of actually fixing a barn is tough to maintain. I mean, that's sort of a known factor when you buy a barn or have lived with one, that they're big, they've got a lot of roof area, a lot of siding, and certainly many of them have a lot of age to them. So when we go in on our surveying regime, I usually speak with the owners, targeting various foundation issues. There's pretty much some classic structural problems that come with age to an old barn, whether it's the tie beam to post joint up in the upper timber frame, the wall splaying out, that's sort of an Achilles heel to the timber frame of our barns. Water pressure against the rear wall, that hydrostatic pressure sort of blowing out the rear masonry. Siding, of course, a lot of that is sometimes cosmetic, but certainly it does protect the frame and weatherproofs the interior. So that's one thing. I feel that my experience as a woodworker and builder really helps our owners prioritize these projects, identify problems that they may not know that they have, and then we consult with them and try to help them preserve it.
So many questions from just what you said that I have, but something, I don't know whether you can put this into words, but I'll ask the question anyway. You say that when you walk into a barn, you always see a story, that these barns are telling you a story. What are they telling you?
They really, to me, I guess they're really just almost perfect expressions of that agricultural economy from which they sprang, whether it's the relatively primitive log crib barns built between 1750 and 1800, all the way through the big, 100-foot long, glorious barns with Italianate cupolas on it, built in the late 1800s, early 1900s.
Yeah.
And, the whole step of the way, they tell not just the story of hope and ambition for, family and community and country, but they express the craftsmanship of the builders themselves, the engineering and industry and ingenuity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Scott, one of the things that I would like to point out is that these barns have stories for the people that are living in them today.
Yeah.
And this is a thing that Jonathan does a great job in his films, is talking to the people that are living
you.
In the barn. No, really, but that is a neat thing. Great cinematography as well, but is, how the barn, they connect with the barn. Of course, how the barn is used, and that's the one thing, by using the barn, it'll be preserved. So that's the one thing that in our group we're trying to encourage people to understand. Oh, this is not as bad a shape as it might look, because a lot of times the outside might look a little rough, but you go in and the foundation and the framing is in excellent shape.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, you want to say?
Yeah, and if I could just build on something both Kurt and Dave were talking about, is that, my understanding is the best way to keep a barn, healthy and alive is to keep it in production agriculture. But the one of the things I love about barns is their versatility and their resilience. And so, when we were shooting this thing, just the creativity of the people who own barns and who can afford to keep them. And so, okay, they're a barn for housing, dairy or and grain, but also we've got barns that were turned into a wineries, a book, mm-hmm. a bookstore, a veterinary practice,
wedding venues,
but a barber shop in Spring Grove, Pennsylvania. He half of it or two thirds of it is a barn, Don Ruth, and he the other corner is a barber shop where he makes his living. So I just love that people are finding ways to adapt these barns to the 21st century.
Yeah, and pottery studios.
Yep, exactly.
And the list does go on.
It does. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Tonight at 8 on WITF-TV, the documentary Barns of the Susquehanna Valley will air, and I think you'll want to catch this. This is just some beautiful cinematography, and just it's beautiful overall. You'll learn a lot about the history of barns in the Susquehanna Valley, so be sure to tune in tonight at 8. Jonathan Slade, the producer of the documentary, is one of our guests today, along with historic Gettysburg Adams County Barn Preservation Program designer Kurt Musselman and preservation specialist David McClay. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. David, something you said a few minutes ago that I wanted to follow up on. You talked about your background in building, and you mentioned timber. One of the things that makes a barn unique is the timber, the wood that goes into many of the historic barns. So much so that you now have people that are trying to preserve that barn wood to build into houses and other things as well. But where did that wood come from? I mean, again, it's so unique what you see in a barn. Maybe in houses back in the 17, 1800s, although most of them didn't have timber or beams quite as big. That's unique about a barn in my eyes.
That is amazing to envision the felling of the trees from probably virgin timber, some of the sizes of these longitudinal summer beams underneath the barn floor. Sometimes you'll see them, you know, 14 by 20 inches and then spliced together with scarf joints end to end and running, you know, 80 feet down the line, and just tight grained, quite different from a lot of our modern timber. We do have big trees coming out of the forest today, but the growth rings are a lot further apart. They log it for sunlight. And so the material itself is pretty stunning. I mean, I've seen cutoffs from knee braces from barns. It's just a 4x6 piece of wood, and counted, had to use a magnifying glass, counted 350 years of growth across, you know,
three. In a 4x6?
Yeah. Yeah. And that looked, and the radius of it showed that it was part of a much larger tree. So here, that tree might have been, you know, germinated, you know, before Columbus, you know, set foot on this continent. So that's kind of an interesting connection to the natural history of the area. Mostly white oak is what was the species of choice for rot resistance and strength. A little chestnut here and there. A lot of recycling over time, too. We see joinery and rafter plate notches and stuff, you know, reworked into barns over time.
Mm-hmm. No, I just wanted to say, one of the barns that we feature in the documentary is the Star Barn, and which, by the way, I think you could probably look at where it used to be. You could look out your window here at WITF and see it. But we filmed as they were disassembling it, and when we, David mentioned the length and watching them remove these timbers, because they disassembled the barn just from here and they moved it to Elizabethtown. And we were out there, and they were, you know, it was July and it was 100 degrees, and they're like removing these incredible timbers and bringing them down and carefully putting them on a truck. And you see the length of those timbers, and like, I don't, you know, they don't build trees like that anymore.
Yeah. Right. Apparently, yeah, good friends of mine
build trees like that anymore.
Yeah. Well, they don't grow them like that anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, we had one of our listeners said the old barns have huge timbers in them, all hand cut to make them fit. They had to have really big trees. That's not possible to find anymore.
That's not entirely true. I do hear that a lot. We're very close to Michaux State Forest, and in Waynesboro, there's some very good lumber timber companies where you can actually get some big timbers these days. I think proper forest management has led to, you know, that those beams are still there. But like I said, they're not as hard, they're not as dense, certainly not as old as those trees.
And looking at some of these old barns, too, it's not an insult, but you can say engineering-wise, they were overbuilt. They had much bigger beams in them. They had the materials available, so they used them.
Right.
But they didn't need to be. So that's as far as what you build today. Well, you don't need that big of a beam to have a functioning proper barn.
Right.
The other thing I just wanted to comment on, in 1790, there was an agricultural census, and pretty confident, and in Pennsylvania, about 90% of the barns were what they call log crib, which would be your pioneer's barn. They just felled the trees and then stuck them together like Lincoln logs. And then, as David was saying, this is the material a lot of time was recycled, and we see that in barns later on.
Do some of those barns still exist?
Oh, yeah. We had a log crib barn tour one year in Adams County, so we like to pick different themes. This year, actually, on October 6th, we're having a brick ender barn. So that's another building material that you often see. And, of course, if anyone wants to go on that tour, hgaconline.org is our address, and you can get a ticket there. We have limited seating, of course.
And I think the Dillsburg Plantation has a German ground barn. It's a log crib barn.
Yeah.
What is the oldest barn you've ever seen, the three of you?
There's one, Robert Ensminger, who wrote the book Pennsylvania Barn. He came down for one of our tours, and there's a barn near Bonneville that comes that maybe, you know, 1750 or earlier. And so I think that's one of the oldest we've been in.
Yeah, in Adams County. Yeah, and Adams then County. There is a statewide organization, Historic Barn and Farm Foundation of Pennsylvania, that has annual barn tours. And I think I've seen a 1718 barn on one of their tours. So they, you know, like you say, use big, good materials, they last.
Jonathan, what about you? Oldest one you've seen?
Well, I think the oldest one I've seen is actually in Maryland, and it was in New Windsor, Maryland, and they disassembled it a number of years ago. Somebody was going to come by and like you were talking about, like, reclaiming stuff and turning it into floor
right,
and the farmer was elderly, and he didn't want that to happen, so he donated it to the Carroll County Farm Museum, and so they disassembled its entire barn and then reset it up. So it's reconstructed, but it had timbers in it from it was up, they believed, when George Washington was president. That's how old the barn was.
I saw a couple of you wince when I mentioned that about barns being disassembled and reconstructed as part of homes.
Yeah, we had a recent, or not too recent, but about 5 years ago, a front page article in the Gettysburg Times is barn saved, and it was a barn being taken down, and it never appeared anywhere, you know, reconstructed. I mean, so the Star Barn, there are legitimate projects where they do that, but this was more like the Ark and the Covenant in, you know, Crusaders of the Lost Ark. Nobody ever saw that barn again. So I sort of feel like that's not really saving the barn. I mean, obviously you're saving the materials, but what we like to do to save the barns is help out the owners with a grant program we've been running for about 6 years. And we've given out over $13,000. And the maximum grant we gave out actually is $2,500. But we've had 11 barn owners have been able to benefit and keep their barn going for decades to go because the foundation is repaired, the roof repaired. So it doesn't always need to be a mega project, hundreds of thousands of dollars to save that barn. And that's the wincing part. The other thing is, if you get into this gigantic expense, and the Star Barn is such a beautiful project, but if you took that money and put it into the Adams County Barns, I think we'd have about 200 more barns preserved.
Right, well, let's talk about the Star Barn, Jonathan, because, as you said, we could almost see it from here, where its original location now has been reconstructed outside of Elizabethtown, reconstructed, not remodeled, but a little bit
upgraded. I think they have to go to code and things like that.
Yeah. But when the Star Barn would be described, the word historic was always in front of it. I used to also think that, that it was unique. What made the Star Barn, makes the Star Barn historic and unique?
Well, according to the folks I chatted with in the documentary, it was built right after the Civil War, and it was sort of built as a sign of hope that, hey, we made it through the Civil War, and it had these wonderful stars on the gables. And it was just, that was kind of a unique design element in the area. And so it also helped, well, it helped and it hurt, that it was part of a larger farm that was divided by a highway a number of years ago. And once it got divided by the highway, it really couldn't function as an agricultural, production anymore. And so people were trying to save it for a long time, but it was right there along the road. People would stop and, you know, they would take their wedding photographs there. They would take their, you know, baby shower photos. And so it just became like one of the landmarks. Yeah, a landmark and one of the most photographed historic barns, like, people, we believe, in the country.
But there were other barns that have stars in the gables.
This one was of a unique design, I think, and something else they told me about, you know, a lot of times you harvest the timber to build it right there on the property, but according to some folks we talked to, the timbers from this was actually came on a boat from New York State. So just, you know, the guy who built it had a lot of money to build it back at the time, and so it was a showpiece and also a functioning piece of, you know, agricultural.
Yeah, a good friend of mine, a fellow timber framer down in Adams County, Peter Bugler, was sort of the foreman of the deconstruction of the frame, and in terms of, he would come back and just describe, you know, it, like Jonathan said, the length of these timbers. The rafters were like 43 feet continuous, and the joists themselves were like 65 feet long. He actually has a piece of scrap that has a peg in it when they lashed the pine logs together and floated them down the Susquehanna. So pretty impressive. And he just spoke again of just like the masonry, like you could actually just do all your work in this huge barn without ever having to go outside if that was needed.
And those guys were like surgeons. We filmed them. I mean, whenever we were moving those timbers, they were amazing. I mean, they got hammers and everything, but the way they were moving them to make sure the timbers remained intact, it was really impressive work.
You know, something that you mentioned pegs. And you know, some of these barn, the timber is, some of the wood that was used is so thick. I mean, obviously, it's not something you do with a nail or you do with a bolt or something like that. We did one of our roadshow a few weeks ago in Gettysburg, and you know, the pegs. To me, again, that is just so fascinating that you know these pegs are holding this whole thing together.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, just the forethought and planning that it takes to design and construct the timber frame is sort of mind-boggling when you're first starting out. I mean, our modern-day timber framers, you know, we have saws, you know, circular saws and plunge mortisers and all this kind of stuff. But the basic engineering and the design of the joinery is all the same. And you cut all the beams ahead of time, keep your fingers crossed, you end up with this big stack of cut joints, and then put it all together with pegs. So it's just a big wooden puzzle that you spend months laboring over, and then in 1 or 2 days, boom, it's up.
I actually have a question for you. Years ago, somebody told me that, you're the guy to answer this question. Years ago, they told me that like the beams were dry, the beams were green and the pegs were dry, and so that the beams would shrink around the dry pegs and it would hold it tighter. Is that true?
I've heard that as well,
I think that's true.
Yeah, I mean, a good dry locust peg into an unseasoned oak timber, it's sort of all cinched together.
Yeah. Cool.
And also, if the knee braces are dry too, that helps kind of cinch everything.
That's
together.
Cool.
Yeah. We have some emails here. Kit from Montour County says, the big cathedral-type barns are indeed a big part of the cultural landscape in the countryside. Many of the small villages in Pennsylvania have small barns behind the house. Transportation was real horsepower. These small barns were, in essence, garages.
Yeah, but actually we do include those in our barn register, and in recognizing the importance of them to the cultural historic landscapes of Gettysburg, Adams County, and the other small towns around. But yeah, that's a good point. It's not to be overlooked in our mind. Mm-hmm. It's not all about keeping the biggest, the brightest,
Lee from York says, I realize you're talking about barns of the Susquehanna Valley, but I grew up in a barn in northeastern Pennsylvania, and it was totally different from local barns. It had chestnut beams and hemlock siding with a dirt ramp to mow for putting in hay. Can you talk about the differences of local barns from other styles in other areas of Pennsylvania?
Yeah, the one thing I wanted to comment earlier on when we were talking with Jonathan and his growing up with barns and the stone barns and all, that there is an actual barn type, which you referred to as the bank barn, but Professor Ensminger has documented, and they've now architecturally called the Pennsylvania barn, where you have the cantilevered overhang on one side and the entrance to the second level and a bank on the other side. Not necessarily another side, but that's a second characteristic. And there's an area of this kind of barn where it is like 80% of the barns that you would see on the landscape that stretches throughout Pennsylvania and goes down into Maryland and Virginia. And so it was developed and carried basically by the frontiers, settlers that came through these areas. But yeah, you can go 100 miles north or south, or even west into Ohio, they might be scattered, but you don't see them so much. And then even in Pennsylvania, you have characteristics of barns. They had a tour this summer up in Center County, and most all of the barns had three gables. And then in Adams County, our barns almost always have a basement drive-through for wagons because they're built a little bit later than the ones in the eastern Pennsylvania. So it's very interesting, the nuances that you can see as far as the different kinds of barns.
Donna Newville says, I love our special barns of Pennsylvania. I spent much of my young life playing and working in a barn. My mother's ancestor was the builder of the Star Barn.
Oh, right.
I've always
awesome.
Wanted to renovate an old barn into a music recording studio, listening room, cafe. I cry when I see them demolished. I love her memories there, first of all, but the last sentence, I cry when I see them demolished. There have been, I'm sure, so many barns over the years that have been demolished that we've lost that history. We've lost that. I think just the conversation we're having today shows that a lot of people had foresight, though, to, you know, whether they were working barns as part of a farm or just to preserve them because of the history or whatever, that a lot of those structures still exist, but we have lost a lot.
And that's one of the things I wanted to do with the documentary, was try to get some of these barns on film before they disappear. When I did the Maryland Historic Show, literally four of the barns that appeared in that Maryland show, which we shot between 2010 and 2012, they're gone now. We featured them. And I don't know. My wife and I were driving. I'm like, oh my gosh, that barn's in the show. Gone. And so, you know, that part of what we hope to do is draw attention to it and have people think about it.
Yeah, and one of the cornerstones of our preservation project is the barn registry, where we survey document the barns, photograph it, speak to the owners, as I talked about. And we've surveyed nearly 300 barns over the past 15 years out of about 1,500 to 2,000 in the county. But even on our registry, we've lost we've lost five or six, I guess.
Not bad. But Scott, as you point out, it's the owner's appreciation of them that keeps them saved. Yeah. And that's the one thing that we started out before grants is if people know what they have and appreciate it, they'll save it. And that's the thing where we love about your film there, Jonathan, is it is a appreciation of the barns. And so on October 18th, although you can see it tonight on TV, but October 18th, we're having a free showing of his film there on the barns of the Susquehanna at the Majestic Theater in Gettysburg. Everyone is welcome to come on down at 7 p.m. It's a free program. Jonathan will be there. We'll be there. It's a good time.
It's actually my birthday, too. So come celebrate my birthday by watching it at the Majestic
Theater.
It's
all about you, Jonathan.
It is. It is.
I'm glad we sneaked that in under the wire.
I'm curious, though, when farmers are very proud. We have so many farms that have gone down through the generations. So, David, when you say that you talk about the history of some of these barns with the farmers and they preserve it themselves, I guess the point I'm getting at is that I'll bet they appreciate that history, that they love hearing about what this barn has been through, or what their family has lived through with those barns.
Absolutely. I mean, that's really my favorite part of my job is talking to the farmers and the barn owners. Many of whom, as you said, have been four or five, six generations. My great great grandfather built this barn, and they've lived with it every day. I hear their stories and enjoy incorporating that into my own internal narrative of the barns themselves. But I think almost invariably, I'm able to give them, or one of our team is able to give them something, new information, something they've never seen before, whether it's a joinery detail or a inscription, date stones or anything like that. So it's sort of it goes both ways. And I think everyone is enriched by the experience of being out in the field and barn surveys.
We have an email here from Paul who says, my hat is off to these preservationists. Some years ago, I visited Fredericksburg, Virginia, and learned that there were plans to raise the law offices of our fifth president, James Monroe, to build a gas station. It took a massive effort to save President Monroe's offices, which stands today. All efforts to preserve our history, presidents' homes, and PA barns is a respect for our heritage. Again, hats off to your guest. For hosting such a program, but I agree with him 100%.
Yeah, thank him for that comment. That's great.
Very absolutely. Good.
Listener says, any truth that barn floors were made of pine to prevent the horses from slipping?
I've not heard that. Typically, the threshing floor, where the full wagons of hay would be pulled in, so they're typically beefy, thick, wide board. Some of them are 25, 26 inches wide, 2.5 inches thick. Typically, we see them of white oak, again, very strong, rot resistant. There are also early old growth pine was also suitable for that purpose as well. But in terms of traction, I haven't heard that.
Well, we're out of time for this portion of the program. Gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
It was great.
Documentary Barns of the Susquehanna Valley. Hopefully we got you excited to watch the documentary tonight on WITF TV.
Watch.
That's right. That's at 8 o'clock. Jonathan Slade produced the documentary. Historic Gettysburg Adams County Barn Preservation Program designer Kurt Musselman and preservation specialist David McClay. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, guys.
Have a good day.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, we discussed college admissions earlier this week, but tomorrow, public education's challenges in Pennsylvania as we enter the new school year, and we'd like to hear from you as well. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Anyone who has been to a Harrisburg Senators baseball game knows you may have to dodge more than foul balls or drive across Route 462, the bridge between Columbia and Wrightsville, at certain times of the year. What you'll notice, millions of mayflies descend upon both places. Sources, and others in the Susquehanna River, Conestoga River, other waters, bodies of water in central Pennsylvania. If it seems like there are more of them, you're right. But why? Joining us today is Dr. John Wallace, an entomology professor at Millersville University. Dr. Wallace, welcome to the program.
Hi, Scott. It's great to be back.
Also joining us is Eric White. He's a borough council president, the borough of Wrightsville. Councilman White, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks. Thanks very much for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, John Wallace, I said it seems as though there's been an explosion in the mayfly population. Has there been, and why?
Well, an explosion is... Kind of an odd way to put it.
Okay, so, okay. An increase in population.
Yeah, well, you know, I think what we've been seeing is over the last couple decades, there's been improvement in water quality. And mayflies are one of the prominent indicators of where the of how that water quality is in terms of it being bad or being good. And so the we've been working hard, really goes back to the Clean Water Act in trying to improve our streams and rivers, and we're seeing increases in their populations. The tricky part is, where are we seeing them and why?
Yeah, and that's what we're going to talk about here in a few minutes. But what in particular about water quality? I mean, a lot of this would seem to make common sense, that the water's better, that, you know, a species can live and, you know, there are more of them born. But what about water quality? Why does a mayfly need good water quality?
So there's a number of aspects of water chemistry that influence different aquatic organisms, specifically insects. And so one of the things I want to get across in the program is that while water quality in some ways has improved, other aspects of water quality have not. And that's one of the reasons why I think this one particular group of mayflies may be thriving, and we're seeing greater numbers of them. So going back to your question, we see differences in temperature. You know, if we see cooler temperatures, which that is a component that will promote a number of different groups of aquatic insects to survive longer as opposed to, and that has to do with the amount of dissolved oxygen in the water that that given temperature can maintain, the pH of the water, the acidity of the water. And so there's aspects that we've been working on through various organizations, research programs to try and improve that. But at the same time, with some of these mayfly species, specifically the one that we see in mid-June that is overwhelming the bridges along the river, as well as possibly the Senator Games, and that's one that, as a larva, it burrows into substrate, into sediment. So it likes loose sediment. And one of the things that we notice in the Susquehanna River, in the Conestoga, and the Conestoga, all these major tribs to the Susquehanna, and this also goes across the country to the Mississippi, is that we see an increased suspended sediment load. Mm. And that suspended sediment settles out in places where we have dams. And that's one of the things that we have in the Susquehanna that we're seeing some of this, we're seeing a lot of this sediment building up. Well, that along the periphery of the river. And so these larvae thrive in these conditions. So you have water chemistry that's promoting their survivorship, and then you have an in-stream habitat that seems to be growing, and therefore this particular group of mayflies seems to be doing that. And there's other mayflies that are doing well too, but this particular one is doing very well.
So just to kind of dissect what you've just said is that the good thing is the water, the quality of the water is better. I don't know if I'd say it's a bad thing, but maybe not a great thing that there's more sediment in the river. Am I correct in saying that?
That's true. That's one of the biggest problems that Chesapeake Bay has
right now,
in terms of suspended sediment loads. And a number of state and federal agencies are working, as well as universities, are working to reduce that sediment, to make the river not look like chocolate milk as we have these major rain events. Mm-hmm. And that's an ongoing problem. And so that aspect, but there's other, and I don't want to sugarcoat the water quality thing, because there are aspects of water quality, such as pharmaceuticals in the water. There are some bad things that we have going on, but in general, water quality has improved to some extent.
All right, temperature though, and I wanted to follow up on this. You said water temperature. Are you referring to warmer temperatures in water because of climate change?
No. Well, that could be contributing to it, okay? The warmer temperatures tend to insect growth and development is driven by temperature, driven by water temperature. So the warmer the temperature, the faster an insect will grow in the water. And so that's one of the things that we're seeing with regards to climate change, both on land and in the water, is that their insect development, plant development seems to be occurring sooner. Mm-hmm. So we'll see plants flowering sooner. We may be seeing insects sooner in the calendar year, all right, due to these increases in temperatures. With regards to the increase of water temperature, it's not going to be happening as quickly as it does on land. But keeping these cooler water temperatures does actually promote the survivorship of many different groups of insects.
These mayflies don't have a long lifespan, do they?
Not as an adult. In fact, they live as a larva probably 11 months or so. But as an adult, they're about 24 to 48 hours. And so they've got to get out of the water. And what's interesting about mayflies and their development is that the only group of insects that has a molting adult stage that's not reproductive. So what happens is the insect has to crawl out of the water, swim out of the water. It doesn't swim out of the water. It just emerges at the top of the water surface. And it flies to a nearby place where it sits and rests for 10, 15 hours or so. And then it molts its skin again as an adult. Then it's ready to fly and mate and reproduce.
Okay, so
all in 48 hours.
I'm going to say there's a lot going on there. 48 hours. Attracted to light. Okay, I understand that part of that is the reflection off the water on the river. But when we're going to be talking with Councilman White here in just a minute, mm-hmm. About the lights on the bridge between Columbia and Wrightsville. But they are attracted to light, correct?
Right. Insects as well as other organisms are attracted to unpolarized light that you see coming from lamps and light bulbs, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. We have, before I get to Councilman, we have a listener ask, what color porch light can I use to not attract mayflies by the thousands? That's a pragmatic question.
Yeah. I would try filtering it somehow. And again, I don't know where this individual is. If they're along the river, I would suggest turning their light off at a certain time of in the evening.
Okay.
That's not so much of an option for the bridge, though.
Eric White is the Wrightsville Borough Council President. Councilman White, I have to admit that a couple years ago, is that 2 years ago that there were so many? Was it three years ago?
2015, yeah.
For those who haven't seen the pictures or didn't witness it firsthand, describe what the bridge looked like that weekend in June.
Well, you had piles. You had literally piles of dead mayflies at each light, spilling out up to a foot thick down the side and onto the deck of the bridge, which created some serious safety issues for cars sliding, motorcycle sliding, that sort of thing. There were that many millions of dead carcasses.
You actually did have a couple crashes, right?
Yeah, there was a couple accidents back then. That was before my time on council, but I was living in Wrightsville, of course, at the time, and we dealt with it. And crossing the bridge was just horrendous at night. It was like going through a blizzard of things that just landed on your windshield and never went away.
So how did the borough council become involved? There's a project that we're going to talk with Dr. Wallace about in just a moment at Millersville. But how did the council decide that this is such a problem that we got to get involved in this?
Well, I mean, less than who? I mean, our citizens suffer with this. So everyone that lives along the riverbank, you know, has the issue. Folks in Columbia have the issue. The thing that really kind of brought it to my attention was that PennDOT is planning a major renovation of the bridge in the 2020 to 2024 range. And if we're going to do something to try to curb the problem or control the problem, that would be the time to do it. And I remembered the good doctor there from the 2015 episode and contacted him and see if there's anything, if he had any ideas, which of course he does.
Now, 2015 is when is that the time of year when they're most active?
That particular species, yes.
Okay. So in June of 2015, what's it been like in June or over the summer months since then? Has it been bad?
It was a little later this year. They came a little later this year and lasted a little longer. And our only choice the previous year and this year, our only choice was to turn the lights off after we ran the doctor's experiment, was to turn the lights off for a couple of weeks until they went away. We just recently turned the lights back on.
Obviously, automobiles and vehicles have their headlights on, so it's like traveling on a highway normally. But do you see that as a safety problem with having to turn those lights off?
Well, yeah, that's our biggest concern, because our 462 bridge is a walkable bridge, a bikeable bridge, and we do have an awful lot of people that walk the bridge and ride their bikes across there. It's part of the rail or the trail, you know, the trails that go through the center of Pennsylvania. So it is a big concern that we really need the lights on for safety. Mm.
So let's talk about this project, Dr. Wallace, at Millersville. What are you doing?
So right now what we're doing is we're collecting some baseline data on the numbers of mayflies that are coming off. And one of the things working with Eric is we wanted to see, okay, is there a difference between lights on versus lights off? The thing to keep in mind is that these mayflies are following an unbroken path, if you will, of reflected polarized light that's coming off the river. And all of a sudden, they get whacked with this bright, unpolarized light from the bridge. But then there's kind of a double whammy that goes on there. They're also attracted to the polarized light off the asphalt and off the car paint. And so what happens is a lot of these mayflies just stay up there and they'll lay their eggs on the road.
Uh-oh.
And so now you've got this, you know, compounded problem. So what we're trying to do is try to understand what species are involved, the numbers of them, when and where they are on the bridge. So we collected mayflies from one side to the other. We're looking at what the density of them per hour, the length of emergence period. It's all to collect some baseline information so we can start to possibly manipulate some things in the upcoming summers.
Okay. I'm sure you have, but what would some of that manipulation be?
Well, some of the research is not very much. There aren't very many papers out on this, and some of the research indicates that if we could, and this is actually something I talked to Eric about, if we could create a distraction, in other words, if we can create put light sources up that are lower to the river, and get the mayflies basically flying under the river. Mm. Okay. The other thing is filtering or blocking the lights. And this is something I've talked to Eric about on the bridge. If we can do that, because remember, I should point out that aquatic insects tend to fly upstream to lay their eggs. And it's because during their larval stage, they're drifting downstream. And so their MO, if you will, is to emerge and fly upriver. And so what happens is these lights break that polarized path of the river, of the light reflected off the river. And it's kind of like, you know, yelling squirrel at someone who's easily distracted, you know, and all of a sudden they get hit with that, and that's where they go. And so we're going to try a number of different things to get them back on their riverine path to lay eggs.
Well, this is a fascinating topic. I also understand that you've thought about using these carcasses, if you will, for fertilizer, right?
Well, that's another can of worms, so to speak, Scott. So you know, I have some colleagues that they're looking at the role of insects in terms of human diet. One of the things I thought about was, what could we try to use them as fertilizer? And so that's something we're going to be doing in one of my classes this semester.
Human diet? I mean, that doesn't sound like...
It's with these mayflies, there are some that, especially in some areas of East Africa, where they're making meat patties.
Wow.
How about that?
There's not a whole lot of meat to this. I understand what you're talking about. I know what you're
they're
saying.
High in protein.
Dr. John Wallace, an entomology professor at Millersville. Eric White, Wrightsville Borough Council President. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
And obviously it's something that we'll keep an eye on, because we won't have a choice, I think, in Wrightsville, Harrisburg, all along the river.